Tyrell Trefa obtained entry into the United States. Now, the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate had been very closely affiliated with the Romanian Orthodox Church. Now, as the Cold War really got underway, and as, of course, Romania was occupied by the Soviet Union as the Axis forces were driven back, and a communist government was set up in Romania. Now, as Cold War feelings heightened in the United States, the fact that the bishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate had been appointed by the head of the Romanian Orthodox Church in Romania, which at that time was governed by communism, although they had no perceptible effect on the church itself, aroused a great deal of bitterness and suspicion on the part of a great many people, a great many Romanian emigres in the United States, as well as by the federal authorities themselves. Now, in a really a sort of a violent takeover, the Iron Guardists, many of whom came into the United States at the end of World War II under, for a variety of different reasons, seized control of the Grass Lakes, Michigan seat of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. And they did so. They kicked out a fellow by the name of Moldovan, M-O-L-D-O-V-A-N, who was the bishop appointed by the head of the Romanian Orthodox Church, and they basically broke the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate off from the Romanian Orthodox Church, and the man who became head of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate was none other than Viorel Trefa, but he changed his name to Valerian Trefa in order to sort of maintain his religious front, I guess you might say. So when you hear the name Valerian Trefa in the passage I'm just about to read to you, keep in mind that's the same fellow as Viorel Trefa, the fellow who gave that blood-curdling speech which kicked off the horrible pogrom and, you know, the slaughtered corpses and so forth, which Nip just read you. Returning again to Wanted, the search for Nazis in America, by Howard Bloom. While Kramer traveled through Romania and then Israel in a small car he had bought in England, Valerian Trefa solidified his power as bishop. He now controlled an episcopate with 46 churches, mostly in Ohio, and 10,000 parishioners. The Vatra, that is the seat of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate, the Vatra, which his supporters had taken by force, was now officially his. Bishop Moldovan's legal challenges were defeated. An Ohio district court, reaching its decision in the midst of the McCarthy era, decided, quote, "The communistic government of Romania was dictating appointment of its bishop, Moldovan, and the American diocese was entitled to revoke its 1936 bylaws and elect its own Bishop Trefa."
Let me just mention, too, in opposition to this, that what's going on, of course, we don't really have time to read the whole passage to you. When they say that it was taken over by force, that is literally true. Viorel Trefa and essentially a gang of ex-Greenshirt and Iron Guardist stormtroopers literally came to the Vatra, the Romanian Orthodox Church, the center, and literally dragged the priests out, beat them up, broke legs and arms, and literally took the place by force. Now, bear this in mind, because this was later received official sanction in the United States as a way to transfer power of a bishop, because supposedly the other bishop was appointed by a communist church. Bear this in mind, especially because, as we mentioned earlier, parallels to Central and South America, that currently people like Archbishop Oscar Romero have been shot dead in El Salvador for siding with the poor people, and priests and nuns and others are being shot dead all over Central and South America for going against the powers that be.
Okay, now we're going to be talking about that again some more in the next broadcast of Radio Free America, which we're going to talk specifically about the Galen organization. Okay, returning again to Wanted, the search for Nazis in America. As a bishop and a fierce anti-communist who had fled his native land supposedly to escape red oppression, Trefa moved in influential circles throughout Cold War America. He made broadcasts over Radio Free Europe to Romania, broadcasts he bragged were arranged, quote, "by my good friend J. Edgar Hoover," unquote. He sat on daises with the governor of Michigan, and his picture appeared in newspapers shaking hands with a smiling Hubert Humphrey. On Wednesday, May 11th, 1955, Bishop Trefa had the honor of offering the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate. Quote, "Almighty God, who has made America trustee of priceless human liberty and dignity, Look down from heaven upon thy servants now present before thee and bless them, that they may remember in their discussions and decisions Romania and all the oppressed nations who are still longing for, quote, a government by the people and for the people, unquote. Bishop Trefa's presence had been requested by Vice President Richard M. Nixon. Keep in mind here that Richard M. Nixon could have selected any clergyman in the country to give the opening convocation before the U.S. Senate. He selected Bishop Trefa. Keep in mind that Trefa also associated with his opponent in the 1968 election, Hubert Humphrey. Okay? Continuing with one of the search for Nazis in America. At the time, Kramer said, if I had been in the country, they never would have let Trefa into the Senate or on Radio Free Europe, unquote. But years later, after the revelations of contemporary history, the dentist had become more cynical. He now believed Hoover had been aware of Trefa's past, but in the interests of anti-communism, was willing to make a practical alliance with an Iron Guard commandant. Just as the newly formed CIA quickly and expediently forgot past grudges to draft Nazi spy chief Reinhard Gehlen's agents, Hoover could have sought out and protected Trefa. Significantly, Kramer was to learn, following the collapse of the Antonescu regime in 1945, Antonescu being the fascist head of state of fascist Romania, Trefa had worked in Vienna as an agent for Gehlen's spy network. Also, Kramer decided it was no political accident that Richard Nixon invited Trefa to the Senate. It seemed more than coincidental that Richard Nixon had a rather incriminating history of involvement with another Iron Guardist who had also immigrated to America, Nikolai Malaksa. Pausing here very briefly, notice the work that Trefa does for Reinhard Gehlen. Notice his alleged association with J. Edgar Hoover and quite possible association with J. Edgar Hoover, the same J. Edgar Hoover who worked with the Nazi Interpol, the same J. Edgar Hoover who was very active in aiding Chambers' allegations against Alger Hiss. And notice also that Richard Nixon, Hiss's gadfly in the House Un-American Activities Committee, is also an associate here of Bishop Trefa's, invites him to give the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate. And as we've seen here, that Richard Nixon was also associated with Nikolai Malaksa, who is the financier of the Romanian Iron Guard movement.
Now, damning as Richard Nixon's participation with VRL Trefa might seem, it pales into insignificance when held up against his activities on behalf of Nikolai Malaksa. Nikolai Malaksa, as Dave mentioned, was the chief contributor to the Iron Guard. He was the wealthiest man in Romania. And as we'll see, he made some very important and influential friends, both during and after World War II. Reading again from Howard Bloom's Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. During the 1930s, Malaksa had perceptibly invested a sizable loan from the Romanian government intended for his locomotive factories into other industries. By 1939, he had purchased controlling interests in numerous steel, rubber, munition, and artillery factories. Malaksa had seen the future of Europe and had realized the next decade's profits were to be earned from guns, not butter. Malaksa, though, was not just a businessman. He also was a political force in Romanian politics, an agent who actively worked and conspired with the Nazis and the Iron Guard. From his factories, Malaksa hoped, would come the weapons which would win the new order. In 1936, Malaksa went to Berlin to meet with Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, and the two men parted as business partners. This personal agreement became formalized in the 1940 Volstadt Pact, which integrated Malaksa's industries with Germany's. Directing this new Nazi industrial coalition were Nikolai Malaksa and Albert Göring, younger brother of the Reichsmarshal.
Okay, now, keep in mind that what we're talking about here is not only the financier of the Iron Guard movement, but a business partner of not only Hermann Göring, but a fellow who was actually who would sign the contract with Albert Göring, his younger brother. Returning again to Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America by Howard Bloom, the LUM. On September 29th, 1946, Malaksa arrived in New York as part of a Romanian government trade mission. He was never to return to Europe. In 1948, Malaksa formally applied for permanent residence in the United States, appealing for admission under the Displaced Persons Act. For the next 10 years, Malaksa was to fight a legal battle to remain in America, the best legal battle his money could buy. Malak's first step was to claim millions of dollars which had been deposited before the war in the Chase National Bank in the name of one of his corporations. These funds had been frozen as enemy assets during the war by John Peel, P-E-H-L-E, of the Treasury Department. Normally, such funds are used for post-war compensation to American companies, such as Standard Oil, which had property confiscated by Romania. However, John Peel had since returned to private practice, and Malaxa shrewdly hired the law firm of Peel and Loesser, L-O-E-S-S-E-R, to argue his case. This time, Peel and Malaxa won. Similarly, Ugo Carusi, C-A-R-U-S-I, was United States Immigration Commissioner when Malaxa first attempted to enter as a displaced person. When Carusi resigned his job, Malaxa hired him. Other former government officials and their associates were recruited and compensated to assist in Malaxa's legal suits. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles's law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, former Air Force Secretary Thomas K. Finletter's law firm, and the firm of former Undersecretary of State Adolph A. Burley, Jr., who personally testified on Malaxa's behalf before a congressional subcommittee on immigration. The briefs of these lawyers, though, were no match for the vivid eyewitness testimony detailing Iron Guard atrocities which were heard at every immigration hearing. A victim of justice, Malaxa tried instead privilege. At Malaxa's urging, the junior senator from California, Richard Nixon, introduced a private bill in 1951 which would allow Malaxa to remain permanently in the United States. Congressman Emanuel Seller, head of the House Immigration Committee, later said on television, quote, "I saw something suspicious about the bill. I held up the bill. The bill was never passed," unquote. The bill was defeated, but it was not the end of Nixon's involvement with Malaxa. Interrupting here to go back over some of the connections of some of the people here who are aiding Malaxa. First of all, the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, whose senior partners were not only Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, but also CIA Director Alan Dulles, as we've previously seen, both men worked hand in glove with the Galen Organization. John Foster Dulles was the primary exponent of the rollback theory of communism. Recall that Sullivan and Cromwell had very profound Nazi industrial connections itself. Sullivan and Cromwell handled the business for I.G. Farben's American subsidiary. They also handled the legal work for the reparations loans that were given to the Schroeder Banking Corporation, the Schroeder Industrial Empire in Germany, which Kurt Schroeder was a very powerful Nazi industrialist and financier who not only had an international banking empire in Britain, Germany, and the United States, but also was the overseer of ITT's many interests in Germany, which included the Focke Wulf aircraft manufacturer, which manufactured one of Hitler's top combat aircraft. And so there are many, many connections of Sullivan and Cromwell. Notice also that Adolph A. Burley, Jr., the very same Adolph Burley, Jr. who was powwowing with Whitaker Chambers about Alger Hiss in 1938, the very same Adolph Burley who's powwowing with J. Edgar Hoover and helping to standardize American and German passports with Interpol, the very same Nazi-dominated Interpol, which was headed by Reinhard Heydrich, and of course Nazi Germany had been bombing Britain. Not only did his law firm help represent Malaxa, but Burley personally testified for Malaxa. And of course, Richard Nixon introduces a bill to help allow Malaxa to stay in the country, and as indicated there, that was by no means the end of Nixon's activities on behalf of Malaxa. Keep in mind that Nixon was Hiss's primary accuser in the House on American Activities Committee.
Continuing on, it says, the Romanian, meaning Malaxa, or one of his lawyers or advisors, now had a new scheme. In May 1951, at the height of the Korean War, when all industry was under wartime control, Malaxa organized the Western Tube Corporation. The company, of which Malaxa was treasurer and sole stock owner, $1,000 worth, planned to manufacture seamless tubes for oil refining. Let me go back and point that out to you real quickly. Okay, during the Korean War panic, all industry under wartime control, Malaxa organizes the Western Tube Corporation. He is sole stock owner to the tune of $1,000. What we're talking about is a dummy company. $1,000 worth of stock is nothing, and he was the sole stock owner. Although most similar manufacturing was done in the East, Molox's plan was to construct facilities on the West Coast, near the California oil fields. It had taken Meloxa 5 years in the United States to locate what he insisted was the perfect site for new industry, a small suburb east of Los Angeles, Whittier, California. And for Meloxa's purposes, the site was perfect. It was, coincidentally, the hometown of the then junior senator from California, Richard Nixon. This was, for Meloxa's purposes, just the first of many perfect coincidences. Western Tube's California address was 607 Bank of America Building, Whittier. This was the same address as that of the law firm of Bewley, Krupp, and Nixon. Throughout his Senate career, Nixon's name remained part of the official firm title, and Nixon used the office on his vacations in California. Thomas Bewley, Nixon's longtime friend and law partner, was secretary of Western Tube, Meloxa's dummy company. Herman L. Perry, the vice president of Western Tube, was an old Nixon political supporter, the same, quote, family friend whom Pat Nixon credited as the man who, quote, got Dick to oppose Congressman Jerry Voorhees.
Now keep in mind, the same Jerry Voorhees who was one of the prime congressional opponents of I.G. Farben and was working very hard to break up I.G. Farben. His stay in Congress was removed by Richard Nixon.
Indeed. On May 17, 1951, the Western Tube Corporation filed for, quote, a certificate of necessity to give top wartime priority to its materials and personnel. Also, the company filed a petition seeking first preference quota for its treasurer, Nikolai Meloxa, on the grounds that he was indispensable to the operation of Western Tube. These two applications were personally promoted by Senator Nixon. Nixon telephoned the executive assistant to INS, Commissioner James Hennessy, to plead for Meloxa's permanent entry. And a letter sent by Nixon to the Defense Production Administrator marked urgent insisted, quote, it is important strategically and economically, both for California and the entire United States, that a plant for the manufacture of seamless tubing for oil wells be erected. Urge that every consideration it may merit be given to the pending application. Bear in mind, again, this is a company that has front capital of $1,000, and all of the partners are members of Richard Nixon's law firm and personal friend circle of friends. Both appeals were successful. The application for Western Tube was quickly approved, and on September 26, 1953, Meloxa was admitted from Canada under a special first preference petition as a permanent resident. Yet, once Meloxa obtained permanent residence in the United States, nothing further was ever done to make Western Tube a reality. Neither Meloxa, nor Nixon, nor any of the corporation's other sponsors ever again concerned themselves with Western Tube. Congressman John Shelley of California was later to observe, quote, it is impossible to discover any reasons for creating Western Tube and seeking a certificate of necessity other than to give Meloxa a springboard for entry into the United States.
This, while Hiss's case, while Alger Hiss is being convicted of his communist sympathies in a court of law. Okay, so again, keep in mind, Chambers' Nazi sympathies, Hoover's Nazi sympathies, Adolf Burley's Nazi sympathies, and Richard Nixon's Nazi sympathies. Now, the name perhaps most identified with Cold War anti-communism is, of course, Senator Joe McCarthy and his infamous Senate hearings in which he destroyed many, many lives and many, many careers. Now, we're going to get right into Joe McCarthy's Nazi connections. They are hard, they're undocumented, and the book that we're going to talk
they
about...
They are documented.
I said they are. What did I say?
You said undocumented.
They're well documented. It's getting late, and at 3.5 hours, they're very well documented. What I meant to say is that what I was in the process of thinking was the fact that this needs no introduction here, that the documentary source that we're presenting here really gives you all the background that you're going to need to understanding the Nazi connections, the Nazi sympathies, because they're both there, of Senator Joe McCarthy. We're going to be reading to you from a book called The Nightmare Decade. The Nightmare Decade was authored by Fred Cook, Fred J. Cook, C-O-O-K, published in hardcover by Random House, copyrighted 1971. Talking of Senator Joe McCarthy. In his first 3 years in Washington, McCarthy had already been designated the Pepsi-Cola Kid and the Winter Boy of the real estate lobby. He was soon to be identified in another far more devastating way as defender of the Nazi SS troops at Malmedy. Malmedy has gone down in history as one of the horror words of World War II. It was in this small Belgian crossroads at Christmas time in 1944 that the 1st SS Panzer Regiment under Colonel Joachim Peiper, P-E-I-P-E-R, wrote a new chapter in depravity. Colonel Piper's elite outfit had become known as the Blowtorch Battalion after it had burned a couple of Belgian villages and slaughtered everyone in them. With this deeds on its record, it came to Malmedy at Christmas time and rounded up some 150 captured American soldiers and 100 Belgian civilians. Colonel Piper told his men Germany had her back to the war. She could not afford the luxury of prisoners. So the captives were taken out into the fields and machine-gunned to death by the Nazi troopers, who laughed hilariously at the sport. In the subsequent war crimes trials, 74 members of the Blowtorch Battalion were tried for their roles in the Malmedy massacre. 43 were convicted and sentenced to die, but legal maneuvers stalled the immediate execution of the sentences. Months dragged by, and the American public began to forget. With interest flagging, the condemned men now took the offensive. From their death block cells, a stream of affidavits poured forth. These accused their American captors of the most hideous tortures. In almost identical language, note that phrase, in almost identical language, the affidavits alleged that false confessions had been wrung from the captured SS troopers by lighting matches thrust under their fingernails and by brutal beating of their abdomens and genitals. In Germany, these charges generated headlines, and the headlines began to create a wave of anti-American feeling. The mood of the times was also changing. The wartime thrust for vengeance against the Nazis was being tempered by the strains of the Cold War. Russia, so recently our ally, loomed as the new threat to the peace of Europe and the world, and American foreign policy was being recast on the premise that we would need West Germany's help in the trials of the future. Interject here. Keep in mind all the background that we have given you about this. Such pressures made American officials exceptionally sensitive to the torture charges of the Nazi SS troopers. In this atmosphere, the U.S. Supreme Court granted a review of the Malmedy death sentences. It upheld the verdicts. In Germany, the communist press seized upon the decision and twisted it for its own propaganda purposes. The Supreme Court demonstrated, it contended, that it was impossible for Germans to obtain justice in America. Keep in mind, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the death sentences. The propaganda in Germany became so intense that the U.S. Senate began to worry. In April of 1949, the Senate Armed Services Committee appointed a three-man subcommittee to investigate the Malmedy massacre. The committee was headed by Senator Raymond Baldwin, a mild-mannered and thoroughly decent Republican from Connecticut. McCarthy was not one of the members of the committee, but he demanded the right to sit in, unquote, at the hearings. Baldwin granted him permission. McCarthy pressed more demands. He submitted a list of witnesses he wanted the committee to call. Again, the committee acquiesced. He demanded the right to cross-examine witnesses, and again, Baldwin yielded. From that point on, there was almost no chance of holding orderly hearings, for McCarthy virtually took over the investigation, castigating witnesses, storming through the hearing room, impugning the motives of the committee and its counsel, Marine Colonel Joseph Chambers, a Congressional Medal of Honor winner. Note that. He's hassling a Congressional Medal of Honor winner here. Why had McCarthy gone to such lengths to insinuate himself into the dispute? Why did he rage in defense of the Nazi murderers of American soldiers?
Continuing with the nightmare decade to answer those rhetorical questions, the answer lies in the influence exerted by some of McCarthy's ultra-conservative, even pro-Nazi backers in Wisconsin. McCarthy had been bankrolled in his political campaigns by such leaders of Wisconsin's powerful German-American community as Frank Seusenbrenner and Walter Harnischfeger. Seusenbrenner was the president of the Kimberly Clark Paper Company and was the president of the board of the University of Wisconsin. Harnischfeger was president of the Harnischfeger Company of Milwaukee, makers of traveling cranes, overhead machinery, and prefabricated houses. Both men were known as being fiercely pro-German. McCarthy showed not the slightest repugnance for Harnischfeger's passionate ultra-rightism and admiration for Hitler. Before the war, one of the manufacturer's nephews attending the University of Wisconsin had shocked fellow students by displaying an autographed copy of Mein Kampf and flaunting a watch chain swastika. During the war, Harnischweiger had advocated a negotiated peace with Germany. And as soon as the war ended, he played a leading role in organizing a German relief society. The Harnischweiger Corporation was one of eight Midwestern concerns holding war contracts that were ordered by the President's Fair Employment Practices Commission to stop discriminating against workers because of race or religion. The commission charged on April 12, 1942, that these firms had refused to employ Jews or Negroes and had advertised for only Gentile white Protestant help. After 1945, Harnischweiger made several trips to Germany. He criticized the dismantling of German factories, denounced the war crimes trials, and urged the restoration of Germany's colonies. After Joe McCarthy became senator, he inserted Harnischweiger's pronouncements in the Congressional Record. And Upton Close, the pro-fascist radio commentator, parroted the views to his radio audience.
Note a couple of things here. Note that Harnischweiger, who is McCarthy's primary backer here, along with Frank Susenbrenner of Kimberly-Clark, who make Kleenex, note that Harnischweiger is obviously very sympathetic and during World War II was actually, to a certain extent, implementing the very same Nazi racial policy generated at the Wannsee Institute that we've talked about ad infinitum here almost. Note also that Harnischweiger was just like Herbert Hoover and the other people, an opponent of denazification of Germany and of maintaining the American and German industrial interests that had brought fascism into being in the first place.
Continuing the nightmare decade, McCarthy's 1947 financial troubles, stemming from his stock market reverses and his heavy overload of loans from the Appleton State Bank, appear to have been cured by this Wisconsin angel. Quote, "I have made complete arrangements with Walter Harnischweiger to put up sufficient collateral to cure both our ulcers," McCarthy finally wrote to his harried banker friend Matt Shue. At the time of the 1948 presidential election, McCarthy listened to the returns in Harnischweiger's home. The industrialist's interest in prefabricated housing was believed in Washington to have been one of the reasons that McCarthy had so interested himself in this issue. In terms of the Malmedy investigation, Anderson and May described the McCarthy-Harnischweiger axis in these terms. Quote, 10 days after the Malmedy investigation was begun, a young man named Tom Korb arrived to act as McCarthy's brains on the case. Korb, K-O-R-B, worked for 6 weeks, carried on the books as McCarthy's, quote, administrative assistant. He stayed long enough to help Joe write a speech on the Malmedy massacre, delivered on July 26, 1949, and then he went back to his job as a lawyer and corporation official in Milwaukee. His employer, the Harnischweiger Corporation.
Continuing now with The Nightmare Decade by Fred Cook. The first witness called by Senator Baldwin at the hearings was Lieutenant Colonel Burton F. Ellis, who had been the chief prosecutor of the Malmedy Nazis. Ellis had been testifying for approximately 1 minute when McCarthy interrupted and denounced him for making, quote, phenomenal statements, unquote. One of the senators who was on the committee, as McCarthy was not, tried to set the record straight with a mild observation. This hearing is not a prosecution. What we are attempting to do is just get the witness's statements, and we will be the judge of whether they did things in the right manner. I entirely disagree, snapped McCarthy. If that is the purpose, I am wasting my time, unquote. On April 22, 1949, the committee called Kenneth Ahrens, A-H-R-E-N-S, one of the 12 American survivors of the massacre. Ahrens testified that he had escaped execution only by tumbling into a ditch and pretending to be dead, and he described how the Nazi machine gunners roared with laughter as they went about their work. This testimony sent McCarthy into one of his typical rages. He accused the veteran of trying to turn the hearing into a Roman holiday, unquote, denouncing Ahrens for attempting to inflame the public, unquote. He charged that some of the American interrogation team that had questioned the Malmedy Nazis were Jewish, that a few of them were 39ers, unquote, meaning refugees from Hitler in that year, and that they constituted a vengeance team, unquote. He lashed out at the military court judges as morons, unquote, and then he thundered, I think you are lying. You may be able to fool us. I have been told you are very, very clever. I am convinced you cannot fool the lie detector. He wound up this tirade with an ultimatum. Either the Americans who testified against the Nazis would be compelled to take lie detector tests, or he would withdraw from the hearings. The effrontery of it was stunning. Here, one who had no legitimate status in the hearing room, except as a matter of courtesy, was laying down conditions about the conduct of the hearings. As a former judge, McCarthy certainly knew that lie detector tests have no validity in American courts, but he pressed his demands so strenuously that Senator Baldwin finally put the issue to the full Senate Armed Services Committee. The committee, of course, voted it down, and McCarthy did indeed storm out of the hearings, calling them a shameful farce, unquote, and a deliberate and clever attempt to whitewash the American military, unquote. Senator Baldwin, he charged, was criminally responsible, unquote. And, again, keep in mind the Nazi sympathies, the Nazi racial policies of Walter Harnischfeger, his financial backer and bailer out, so to speak. Keep in mind that he not only assailed the Colonel Chambers, a Marine Medal of Honor winner, he intimated that the people who interrogated the Nazis were Jewish and intended that as a defamation. Okay, that was supposedly to smear these people. Okay, keep that in mind, and keep in mind how he harassed one of the 12 survivors of the Malmedy massacre, a man who had narrowly escaped death, and accused him, the survivor, of sensationalizing the hearing.
Turning into a Roman holiday. And bear in mind, all of this was done in support of German soldiers accused of massacring American soldiers. There's your true blue American patriotism for you. Well, one of the key things about McCarthy, as we go into the last segment of the show here, one of the key things about the McCarthy era that a lot of people these days do not realize, especially people under 30 who have grown up since the McCarthy era ended, do not realize the profound effect that the McCarthy era, which was not just Joseph McCarthy, it was the whole House Un-American Activities Commission, the China lobby purges of the State Department, and Truman being buffaloed into the giving free hand to the CIA, and a variety of things that happened during the late 1940s and 1950s, as well as some other things that happened in the outside world, that literally led to the situation where it was a purge analogous only in recent history to the purging of the German intellectual center and center left in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, and literally to the extent where anybody to the left of John Wayne was pointed out as a communist and practically driven out of public life with cans tied to their belt and rocks thrown at them.
Now, in order to illustrate just how dramatic the shift in American political awareness and sensibilities has been, we're going to sort of do a little switcheroo on the old sort of before and after thing that you see in so many commercials. You know, they show you the laundry before it's been washed with the brand they're hustling, and then they show you the laundry afterward and how much whiter and brighter it is, okay? Well, we're going to do a variation of the before and after. We're going to give you an after and before. Now, in the very first Radio Free America broadcast, the first part of Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, we read some material from a book called The Great Conspiracy. And that was the material concerning Herbert Hoover's connections with his Russian industrial holdings and his activities as American Food Relief Administrator in financing the reactionary armies in Eastern Europe against the Soviet Union. Now, that information came from the hardbound edition of The Great Conspiracy, by the way, authored by Michael Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, and Albert E. Kahn. Now, we were reading from the hardcover edition, which was published in 1946 by Little Brown and Company. Now, we're going to contrast two paperback versions of the same book and give you an idea of just what it was in a concrete sense that McCarthyism did to the American political spectrum.
All right. Now, if you were to go out looking today for this self-same book, The Great Conspiracy by Sayers and Kahn, you would look in the bookstores, you would look in the libraries, and unless you got extremely lucky at a used book sale somewhere, you would probably look in vain. Today, the place you have to go to get The Great Conspiracy is, in fact, your local, if you have a local, communist, socialist bookstore. All right. Now, on top of this, not only is this the only place you can find this book outside of private collections and perhaps some used bookstores, we're going to try and let you know what this book looks like. I have a copy of the current edition in front of me, okay? I don't even think they've got a copyright date on it. I mean, this is like, we're talking fringe stuff. It just lists the first edition date of 1946. Okay, on the cover, they have an extremely I suppose, impressionistic picture of Adolf Hitler stretching his cartoon of Adolf Hitler stretching his hand across from Europe over the USSR, and a giant red proletarian warrior of stern and noble mien, with a giant sword uplifted to cut off the hand of a rather cowardly and weasel-like looking Adolf Hitler. Okay, now this is published by Proletarian Publishers, which as far as we know doesn't even exist anymore. To give you an idea of the kind of people that publish the book, the only people that will publish this book nowadays, Proletarian Publishers, here's a list of some of the books that they did publish at this time. And this is off the back and the inside back cover. The History of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Political Economy by A. Leontiev. A Veteran Communist Speaks by Joe Dower. Marxism and the National Colonial Question by Joseph Stalin. The United Front by G. Dimitrov. Marxist Glossary by L. Harry Gold. The Communist Party Manual on Organization by J. Peters. Trotskyism, Counter-Revolution in Disguise by M. J. Olguin. On Organization by V. I. Lenin. The Great Conspiracy by Sayers and Kahn. Textbook of Marxist Philosophy. They even have a Spanish version, Historia del Partido Comunista de la URSS. That's History of the Communist Party of USSR. On the inside cover, some other books that they don't list on the back. Mastering Bolshevism by Joseph Stalin on the struggle against Trotskyism and for a Bolshevik party. Stalin's Speeches on the American Communist Party. Exposes the evils of factionalism and American exceptionalism. And Problems of Leninism by Joseph Stalin, on relationship of the party to the masses under the dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, this is what this book has been driven to in this day and age. Back before the McCarthy era, well, I'll let Dave describe it.
Okay, now contrast what you just heard, you know, communists, right? Okay, listen to that. Now contrast this with the paperback edition of The Great Conspiracy, which was copyrighted in 1947, published by Bonnie and Gare Incorporated of New York City. Bonnie is B-O-N-I, Gare is G-A-E-R. Listen to some of the endorsements that appear on the back cover of this book. First of all, Senator Claude Pepper. Now, of course, then Senator Claude Pepper, is now Representative Claude Pepper, still an active member of the U.S. Congress and very active on behalf of senior citizens' rights. Senator Claude Pepper said, and these are some of the little excerpts that they have in review of the book on the back, quote, "There is one book on Russia which I think is the most important book of the day. Henry A. Wallace." Now, Henry A. Wallace was Vice President of the United States under Franklin Roosevelt, okay? "Everyone who is interested in the present and future welfare of the world should read The Great Conspiracy," unquote. That from a Vice President of the United States. "Nothing is more important to peace than that the public should know the facts which in the past have justified Soviet suspicions of the Western powers. This work, exhaustive, authentic, and fully documented, presents this record. I hope that every American will read this book." Joseph E. Davies, former ambassador to the Soviet Union, said that. "A story more fascinating than any fiction, and yet this is sober fact, documented and indisputable, even in its most startling and incredible episodes." That from Professor F. L. Schumann, S-C-H-U-M-A-N, a name neither Niptuck nor I can place. "The excitement of this narrative should not overshadow its serious contribution to a better understanding of the obstacles that still stand in the way of full confidence between Russia and the United States." That from the New York Herald Tribune. "It is about as thrilling a book as the commentator remembers to have read." That from the Detroit News. Now check this next one. "The result makes for stimulating and informative reading of a chapter unique in history, and cannot but be helpful to a better understanding between the USA and the USSR. That from Barron's Financial Weekly. Now, Barron's Financial Weekly is published by the Dow Jones Corporation, who also put out the Wall Street Journal. Okay, it's difficult to think of a name more closely identified with mainstream industrial capitalism. And let me also quickly read you the introduction to the book. This by Senator Claude Pepper, now U.S. Representative Claude Pepper, then a senator from Florida, now a U.S. representative from Florida, and very much in the news, as I said, on behalf of senior citizens' rights. He writes of The Great Conspiracy. "I do not know of a greater contribution which has been made to world peace through better international understanding of Russia, her present as influenced by her past, than Albert E. Kahn and Michael Sayers have made through their great book, The Great Conspiracy Against Russia. If there can be real understanding between Russia on one hand, Great Britain and the United States on the other, there can be a truly lasting peace. We of the Western world know our own past and see it in terms of our own experience, of course. But so few of us know what has been the experience of the people of Russia, and therefore, most of us do not realize why they happen to have their present opinions. What the authors of this book have done is to take the period beginning with the revolution in Russia and let us see the world a bit through Russia's experience. In short, they have bestowed the rare gift for which the poet Burns yearned by letting us see ourselves as the Russians see us, out of their experience. A continuation of the disastrous policies of anti-Soviet intrigue so vividly described in this book would inevitably result in a Third World War. That is why this book should be read and studied by all those eager to see peace durably established in the world. This work is required reading for every American and British statesman, and for that matter, required reading for every citizen of both countries. Surely, if the major nations and peoples of the earth can look upon each other with sympathy and genuine understanding, we have the brightest hope for an enduring peace mankind has ever had in its heart. All of us are debtors to Mr. Kahn and Mr. Sayers for their telling us this story containing so much of pathos and tragedy. Claude Pepper, United States Senator from Florida, June 1946.
All this in description of a book and a whole species of thought now relegated to the bargain basement shelf of American history. One person, again, is at the top of the hour who put it down very succinctly, George Orwell, putting words into the mouth of his character, Winston Smith. If all records told the same tale, then the lie passed into history and became truth. Who controls the past, ran the party slogan, controls the future. And who controls the present, controls the past. It was quite simple. All that was needed was an unending series of victories over your own memory. Reality control, they called it. In newspeak, doublethink.
And quoting from Adolf Hitler's 1935 German language edition of Mein Kampf, the size of the lie is a definite factor in causing it to be believed. Because the vast masses of a nation are in the depths of their hearts more easily deceived than they are consciously and intentionally bad. The primitive simplicity of their minds renders them more easy victims of a big lie than a small one, because they themselves often tell little lies, but would be ashamed to tell big ones. Such a form of lying would never enter their heads. They would never credit others with the possibility of such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts. Even explanations would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, and any trifling reason would dispose them to accept a thing as true. Something, therefore, always remains and sticks from the most impudent lies, a fact which all bodies and individuals concerned in the art of lying in this world know only too well, and therefore they stop at nothing to achieve this end.
And that ends this broadcast of Radio Free America in the second half of our presentation, looking back from 1984, A Hidden History of the Cold War. For Dave Emery and myself, this is Nip Tuck, saying goodnight, and thank you for joining us on KFJC 89.7, Los Altos Hills.
What I have found, a little way away from here while digging in the ground. Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. It's nothing but a picture book they had before the war. Oh, Mommy, hurry, look. There's four or five Melinda girls inside this picture book. Come away, Melinda. Come in and close the door. There were lots of little girls like you before they had the war. Oh, Mommy, hurry, do. There's someone grown up very tall who doesn't look like you. Come away.